Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
One of the true pleasures I receive from being a podcast host in the fly fishing industry is the ability to meet some of the neatest people on the planet. It doesn't take long after meeting John Shuey to realize what a solid person he is. John is the editor-in-chief of the Northwest Fly Fishing Magazine, as well as their sister magazines, Southwest Fly Fishing and Eastern Fly Fishing. He started as a writer in the inaugural edition over 20 years ago. I remember when this regional publication hit the market in the 90s and thinking, what a cool local fly fishing magazine with an amazing design and great photos. John is also the author of some cool local Oregon books, as well as a classic steelhead flies book. We get into all that, plus how the magazine transitioned from the tragic loss of one of their founding partners. It's all in there and it's on deck. But first, I do want to thank our sponsors. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a fly fishing industry professional? Who do you use for your insurance? Bissell has been insuring the fishing industry for over 30 years. As the sole provider for AFTR members and with over 5,600 clients, they have gained authority and have an excellent reputation in this space. Give them a ring. They may be able to offer you a better plan at a lower rate. Contact details at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. Here's a quick word from our favorite fly tying vise.
From the original prototype designed in the late 70s to our brand new legacy stainless steel vise released in 2018, Norvise has been committed to one thing: efficiency. Tie better flies faster. A long-standing slogan with the company truly encompasses what the Norvise fly tying system does. What it means is to tie a fly in less time and more consistently due to the ease and benefits engineered into this outstanding system. For more information, please visit www.nor-vise.com. Norvise, the most innovative fly tying system on the market.
Okay, well, thank you, Josh. And I am very excited to have John Shuey here with us on the podcast. And John is the editor-in-chief of Northwest Fly Fishing, which also encompasses Southwest and Eastern Fly Fishing, as well as being an author of about 18 books.
I think so, Rob. Yeah, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely our pleasure to have you on the show, John. And so we're excited to have a great conversation because you have this great history and heritage in fly fishing, starting the books, what now, 20 years ago, the magazines?
We celebrated our 20th anniversary just this year, so pretty exciting.
Congratulations.
It's amazing how fast it went by.
Yeah, so I really want to get into talking about the history of the magazine because, you know, I remember we've got so many great national publications and international publications, but I actually remember it must have been like 1999
first issue,
right? When we first saw this regional publication,
yep.
The Northwest Fly Fishing.
Yeah, it was a neat story because a couple of friends, Steve Cole, our publisher, and our John Luke, our co-founder and creative director and co-owner, they were friends back in the 90s. And on a fishing trip, they actually conceived the idea of this magazine. And they realized then that it would be a different kind of beast, something that would feature not only great writing, but also great photography, but do it in a... They really wanted to have a journal-style magazine so that we weren't just, a throwaway. Mm-hmm. They really wanted a magazine that people would keep as a reference for future. And people do. Our subscribers tell us all the time that, oh my gosh, I've got a box full of your magazines going back to 2001, you know, and they keep them because they're a reference for a long time because our format's different than everybody else's. Our format's all about destination, and we focus on destinations within the regions that our readers live. So we have the three regions: Northwest Fly Fishing, Southwest Fly Fishing, and Eastern Fly Fishing. And each of those titles focuses on publicly accessible waters within their region. And that's what our readers have told us for 20 years they like about the magazines. They say don't change a thing. So we're very careful if we retool anything.
Yeah, and it has that kind of signature white frame
right
on the cover.
Yep.
So whereas many magazines have these big, beautiful covers. They go edge to edge.
Correct.
Yours is a big, beautiful cover, but instead of going edge to edge, you kind of frame it in this white background.
Yeah, and that was kind of a signature decision by John Luke and how we wanted to present our magazine. There's great covers out there for all the other magazines, too. We just wanted to be a little different, and we wanted to be consistent over the years. And we did change our cover font at one time, but we've never changed our cover style so much. So we keep that framed photograph. We look for a great scenic photo from within the region that has an angler in the shot, but not front and center. We don't do hero shots. We don't do grip and grins. You know, everything we do is just a great scenic fly fishing scene, we've gone with that type of cover for 20 years, and it seems to work. So
scenic rather than the grip and grin.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, other magazines, they do their thing. We just try to stick with what's worked for us. So, yeah.
And then, so who are some of your photographers?
We've worked with all the best ones, you know, and a lot of the up and newcomers, too. I mean, too many to name, honestly. But, you know, you think about some of the great names in fly fishing photography, Barry Beck and Brian O'Keefe and Mark Lance and John Sherman. You know, we've worked with all of them. And many of the up-and-comers, too. And, you know, one of the neat things about fly fishing photography right now, there's just a lot of great talent out there. Some of it's been engendered by the ease of the technology in the digital age, digital photography. But when you put those easy-to-use cameras in the hands of a creative guy, a creative woman, and tell them to go do a shoot, some of them really produce some amazing stuff. So we're not only working with the tried-and-true professionals, but we're also working with some of the newcomers on the block.
If you're an up-and-coming photographer and you've got a great shot, you can submit that?
Well, yes, within some confines. I mean, we like to have contact ahead of submission, so we like to basically give you permission to submit. That's just so we don't get overwhelmed.
Right.
But, yeah, we have guidelines for cover photography, guidelines for interior photography, guidelines for stories and things like that we can send out to anybody that asks. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
You know, Rob, it's really funny because writing fly fishing stories and photographing fly fishing stories is not as easy as it might look when you actually see it in the magazine.
Right.
And so photographers, I tell them all the time, if you're going to be a fly fishing photographer, you've got to forget about being an angler for that moment, for that day.
For a bit.
If you're going to go do the shoot, that comes first, at least if you're working for us.
Right.
You know, you need to go out and get the job done, and that means forgetting about being an angler.
You know, as a videographer, photographer, drone pilot myself, doing the two is not easy.
Not easy.
Yeah. And so you're separating that either per day or half a day or however you're going to do
it.
Sometimes you're just taking pictures.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're not fishing.
Yeah, and you have to accept that as a photographer. You know, you can do your fishing tomorrow, but get the shoot done. I had a great example of that was this last October on the Rogue River. I did a float with Jeff Helfrich on the Wild and Scenic section. We had 2 days. The first day was sunny and gorgeous, and I shot 1,000 frames. And it's a good thing I did, because the next day was cloudy and rainy.
Yeah.
So you put the cameras away.
Well, you're from the Pacific Northwest, so that's kind of not unusual for you.
Not unusual, that's right.
Yeah. Where did you grow up, John?
Grew up in eastern Idaho. Yeah, in fact, when I was just a youngster, 6-7 years old, my dad was a real estate appraiser. And he did a couple summers, he did all the real estate appraisal up in Island Park. In those days, in the summer, he would take me with him, drop me off at a few rivers not to be named. I would just fish all day, and he'd pick me up later at the end of the day. And it was a great way to grow up.
And that's how you got your introduction to fly fishing?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that must have been something.
Well, it was great. And, you know, and then a few years later, my family moved down south of Pocatello in the hills on the Mink Creek drainage. So out the back door was all BLM, and out the front door was basically all Forest Service with all these mountain creeks full of wild cutthroat trout. And at that day and age, you know, kids would just go wander. You know, you're 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, but your parents just turn you loose. And this was before the days of catch and release. And I feel guilty to this day about how many wild cutthroat I might have slayed and put in the freezer in those days, but to the point where mom would say, quit bringing fish home, you know?
Yeah. Well, times certainly changed. So from that point, you're a young man, you're learning how to fly fish there in eastern Idaho.
Yeah.
What are some of the rivers that I guess we could name that would be more well-known rivers in Idaho?
I grew up on the Henry's Fork for my earliest years, and I fell in love with it as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, we actually lived in a town where the lower Henry's Fork was right across the street from us. So, that's as famous as it gets, you know. And then in the latter years when I lived there, before I moved to Oregon with my family when I was in high school, I grew up on some creeks that nobody's ever heard of, but they were just incredible. Fisheries, just chock full of fish.
And you fish right through high school?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, all your friends?
In my Oregon years, a few of them. Yeah, a few of them. You know, that's after I moved to Oregon, and I met a couple guys that I was able to kind of convert from the dark side into the fly fishing world, and you know, and then we had some great times and some pretty epic adventures for a lot of years. Yeah.
So, what was your journey like after high school? What did you do after high school?
I went to the University of Oregon. And my degree is in journalism.
Ducks.
The Ducks, yeah.
Mighty Duck.
Yeah, I came real close to going to the University of Montana.
Okay.
At a weird moment of insight for an 18-year-old, I visited the campus in the fall of my high school senior year and realized at that moment, if I attend the University of Montana, I will flunk work out because I will fish every day.
Yes, whenever,
yeah. So I didn't go. I ended up going to the University of Oregon, which is a great decision because their journalism school is very well known. So my degree and my background is in journalism.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so you graduated with a journalism degree. Then what?
Yeah, and then for a number of years, I did my I had two emphases in my journalism degree. One was magazine journalism, and one was public relations. So I ended up doing some public relations work within and outside of the fly fishing industry. Worked at a fly shop in Salem for a lot of years, a pretty iconic fly shop at the time, and just kind of did what I needed to do. Started freelance writing. I actually had started freelance writing for fly fishing magazines when I was still in college.
No kidding.
And, so started kind of just jack of all trades to make a living and do a lot of fishing and be a deadbeat, for the most part.
And so you used your degree.
I did, and I do. Yeah,
believe that's it or awesome.
It took a while to come full circle to really use it, but yeah.
That's great. And you can actually go to college, go for journalism, and be a journalist.
It can actually work, right? Yeah,
that's great. So you graduated, and you're working at the fly shop.
Yep.
And then, how did this whole story get into like writing books?
Well, my first book was 1999, I believe, and it was because some friends and I had decided that we were going to try to emulate the bait fishermen on the Oregon beaches fishing for redtail surf perch. Now, fishing the Oregon surf is a little different than fishing the Oregon surf down in Baja or something. It's cold and dangerous. But we thought, those fish look like a lot of fun. And we were able to kind of figure it out a little bit and have some success at that. And then the editor of Frank Amato's magazine at the time, Marty Sherman, I told him about it. And he said, that'd make a cool magazine article. So I did a couple articles for him. And then I got to thinking, with all the different kinds of books that Frank Amato publishes, maybe there's something here. So I talked to Frank about it, about the idea of doing a book on a variety of different kind of off-the-radar fisheries in the Northwest. And that's where my first book came from, yeah.
And what was the name of it?
Trout and Beyond.
Trout and Beyond.
Yeah, yeah. And it had chapters on surf perch, on fly fishing for rockfish, which is another saltwater bottom fish, on kind of off-the-wall trout fisheries, on shad, on stuff like that. So,
how did you enjoy the book writing process?
Well, I had some great advice after that first book came out. Now, the first one was a lot of work. Remember, we're talking about the days when a Macintosh had a green screen this big, remember?
Yeah.
Right. So it was a lot of work. But after that came out, a very well-known fly fishing author named Dave Hughes, who I'm sure you know.
Yep.
He cornered me one day and he said, you did a nice job on that. It's a cool book. He said, if you're going to do this, though, keep them in print. And what he meant by that was, you're never going to get rich off a fly fishing book. You're never going to make a living off a fly fishing book, but you can make some income, and you can translate that into more magazine articles sold. But he said the key is, the shelf life, the publishing life of any fly fishing book, it tends to be pretty short. So he said, if you're going to do this, John, keep working at it.
Mm-hmm.
Come up with new ideas and keep those books in print. And he was right about that.
So the more books you have, the more people want to go back and buy some of your earlier books.
Yeah, and each one kind of adds to the success of the next one, as long as you do a professional job of it. I mean, one of the things about fly fishing readers, I've found them to be very astute over the years. They tend to know when an author's trying to shovel them a load.
Sure.
They're pretty bright. And so you have to do a professional job. You have to know your subject matter, research your subject matter, talk to the right people, present the package in an appealing way.
Yeah.
And that's partly on the publisher as well. But as an author, I think you have a responsibility to understand your subject matter and present it in a way that's digestible. Yeah.
So what were some of the early magazines you used to write for?
Well, my very first magazine article, I was a sophomore in college, and it was a magazine called Fly Tire Magazine, but it was the version that was founded by Dick Ciretti.
Okay.
And he still owned it at that time.
Yeah.
And so that's where my first couple magazine articles were sold to him. Not long after, he sold the magazine to a new group of guys. They were great, and I sold a lot of work to them over the years. But it was only 2 years after that when Marty Sherman bought the articles from me on fly fishing the Oregon saltwater. So that's where it kind of started to blossom and became kind of a wellspring of ideas that I had to present in magazine articles. And
sure.
Yeah.
So you were working at the fly shop now in Oregon?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what happened?
Well, let's see. In the mid-90s, I ended up moving to Bend because I got married at the time.
Okay.
And gave that a try. Lasted for a while.
How many years now?
No, that was like 2 years.
Oh, not very long. So this is the second try.
I'm on the second time around.
Okay.
But I moved to Bend, and Bend, Oregon is for the listeners that don't know, Bend, Oregon has had explosive growth. It's the perfect place for an outdoor oriented person because it sits right at the base of the Cascade volcanoes. Just gorgeous scenery everywhere. lots of great trout waters all around, great skiing right there, just everything an outdoors person could want. And so Deschutes County, Oregon has been the first or second fastest growing county in the state for 25 years. So I like to tell people that I lived there, 40,000 people ago.
Okay.
That's what I tell them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, so I lived there at a good time. I lived in Bend when you could walk down the street, you know, and see people you know every time you walk down the sidewalk and everybody says hi. And
yeah.
You could poke your head into a good restaurant and say, yeah, can I get that seat? And they're like, sure, come on in, you know, but it's changed dramatically now.
Well, I'll tell you, when I go to like the Denver shows or all these different shows that I meet people, and if they say they're from Oregon, it's amazing how much love they have for the state.
Yeah, yeah.
And people like really talk about how awesome Oregon is.
We're really lucky in a couple different ways. First off, Oregon's pretty robust in public lands. We have a lot of publicly owned property on U.S. Forest Service and BLM. We also happen to have, we're the 11th largest state in the nation, but our population is just over 4 million. And so it's a lot smaller population than Washington, a lot smaller population than California by far.
Yeah.
You know, so we're pretty lucky that way.
Kind of nestled in there.
Yeah, yeah. And then you add that, you know, sort of the lack of population to our massive amount of public land. There's just a lot of opportunity for outdoor.
And then the coast.
And the coast is great, yeah.
And you've written a book, Oregon Beaches?
Yeah, Oregon Beaches, A Traveler's Companion, yeah. So before that, I'd written a book called Birds of the Pacific Northwest, which is a field guide. Now, this all comes because one day I got to thinking, you know, I really should branch out beyond fly fishing and try to, you know, publish something on other interests of mine. And so that's where that originally came from. But while I was over photographing birds in Yukina Bay on the Oregon coast in March, freezing to death, trying to photograph a couple different kinds of ducks out on the bay, I just had a lot to think about. There was nothing to do but sit there and wait for the ducks to get close. And I thought, you know, I wonder if anybody's ever written about these beaches, you know, and done a guidebook to Oregon's beaches, because we have a lot of beaches with no signage.
Mm.
And our whole coastline, every beach is public. The entire Oregon coast is a public park, public state park, administered by state parks. So I thought, you know, I wonder if anybody's done that. So I went back and I researched, and nobody had ever written a guidebook to the beaches.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I thought that could be cool. So turns out that when I got a hold, I picked a publisher out by just looking at what different publishers were doing. When I contacted that publisher, he said, your timing's excellent because we were just talking about this.
Wow.
Well, that doesn't happen every day,
that's
right?
That's good news.
Yeah. So yeah, that one came out just last year. Yeah, and that one snowballed into the next one because I was down on the coast trying to photograph some beaches on the south coast, and I ran right up against a big music festival. To the point where I couldn't even drive down the access road.
Yeah.
I need to get down. And I thought, well, that's weird. I wonder if anybody's ever written a guidebook to Oregon's festivals.
Yeah.
So nobody had. You know, and I thought, I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but a publisher thought it was, and it's called Oregon Festivals. So
that's cool.
So I've wandered outside my genre for a little while, and now I'll dial it back and get back into my genre of my next.
Well, I mean, it sounds like Oregon's your genre. So
Oregon is my genre, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That's really neat. Well, I'm going to have to spend a little bit more time in Oregon. Actually,
oh, yeah.
A little bit of time in Oregon, because I've actually never been in the state.
See, now being a ski guy, you got a decision to make. You want to come and fish or you want to come and ski?
How about we do both?
It could happen.
I like doing both. I'm actually driving down to the Pleasanton show next week. I was actually skiing up at Stevens Pass a couple days ago, and I'm actually going to be skiing in Heavenly.
Yeah, that's epic.
Yeah. That is epic because it's an epic pass.
That's right. There you go. Perfect.
You did it right.
I hooked that hook just right.
Well, if Oregon had any of these mountains on the epic pass, I would definitely be skiing them. I'm not sure they do. Vail hasn't got their hands on Oregon yet.
Vail hasn't bought Bachelor yet, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's good and bad of Vail buying everything up, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes a bit of a conglomerate, but at the same time, you have access.
Sure. Yeah. Well, then, you know, access is, like we just talked about, access is the critical thing in the state of Oregon. We have a lot of it. If you're an angler,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, man, it's nice to have so much public ground, you know, that you can pursue your craft on.
Well, this is why I'm excited about this podcast, because I'm learning so much great stuff about Oregon. But let's jump back here to Northwest Fly Fishing. Uh-huh. So there they are at camp and having a conversation about starting a regional fly fishing magazine.
They'd come from high-tech backgrounds. They kind of had the ability to put all the pieces together.
Yep.
And John Luke, he had an artistic background, a graphics art background, so he sort of understood design concepts. And what happened was about 6 months after they conceived the idea, they decided to go with a business plan. They got their parents to kind of help invest in it a little bit. They needed an editor. And mm-hmm. so they reached out to some different people and talked to some people in the industry, and they decided that this guy named Steve Probasco was their man.
Yes.
And so they tracked down Steve, and they told him the deal, and he, you know, he was a little bit skeptical at first, thinking, you know, really can this kind of magazine work? But sounds like a good, fun project to be involved in, and they're going to make it worth my while. So he took it, and then just that same year at a sports show in, I think we were in Portland. I was doing the Fly Tying Theater, and I'd never met Steve Probasco, but of course I'd written or read a lot of his magazine articles, and it was kind of funny because he, in a lot of ways, through his writing, reminded me of myself, but he was in Washington and I was in Oregon, so he would do a lot of the kind of the same concepts I did, but in a different state.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, if I ever run into him, that'll be pretty cool to chat about it. Well, I'm sitting there getting my fly tying stuff ready because I'm up next on the theater, and he walks up to me, and he says, Shuey? I said, yeah. I said, Probasco? He goes, yeah. It was that funny. And he goes, I want to talk to you.
Okay.
I go, well, good or bad? He goes, I don't know yet.
We'll find out in
a second.
We're
going to find out, yeah. So he said, he told me the whole story, and he said, we'd love to have you do some writing for us. I go, well, I appreciate that. So, yeah, so for 5 years, I did a lot of writing for Northwest Fly Fishing, including in the inaugural issue. And then they decided it's time to launch other regional titles. So they thought, let's launch Southwest Fly Fishing. They did that. And then let's launch Eastern Fly Fishing. Now, this is a big project. You're trying to bite off half the country, essentially,
right.
and make a regional magazine out of it. Well, they realized that Steve Probasco is only one guy. So they brought me on as managing editor. At the time, our offices were in downtown Seattle, and I'll never forget because they invited me up to the downtown Seattle office, brought me into the office, gave me the whole spiel, talked all about it, you know, told me what my duties would be, responsibilities, all that. It all sounded pretty good, sounded exciting. Sounded fun. They were real excited about it, which was infectious.
I'm getting excited just hearing it.
Yeah, yeah. And but at the end of the deal, it's Steve Probasco, Steve Cole, and John Luke all in the room. I'll never forget because Steve Cole says, all right, he says, well, John, we're going to go with this. We're excited to have you on board. And as our managing editor, you know, you'll work under Steve Probasco. And I'm thinking, it sounds fun. And he says, okay, so there's two ways we can do this. He says, you can be a regular employee and move here to the Seattle area. And I said, stop. He said, you better tell me option two.
One
ain't working.
Yeah, we need to get, I'm Oregon. Which part of me being in Oregon didn't you understand?
Right. So they were great about it. They're like, yeah, that's cool. You just, you know, Steve works from his place, you know, and he's not near Seattle and you can work from your place. Yeah, so that's
so that was option two.
Yeah, that was option two.
Work from home.
Work from home. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you took door two.
I took door two. Yeah, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And you know, some years later, it was time for Steve Probasco to pass the baton on, and I became the editor in chief. And
that's fantastic.
Yeah, so that's what we're running with now. And I know some of the listeners probably are aware of the fact that we lost John Luke tragically here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He was on assignment for the magazines in Texas. There was a boating accident, and as a result of his injuries, he passed away. And just a real tragic situation for us. And
sad.
You know, he was a guy that I talked to every day of my life on the phone.
Unbelievable,
you know,
huh?
Yeah, yeah, just tough. And you know, his wife, amazing woman, and the two high school boys. I mean, just a tough deal. That happened right after the proofs had come out for one of our spring issues. And what that means for the listeners is that the issue had been designed, and it was into the proofing stage where we have actually all the layouts in front of us, and we're just looking for mistakes. Correct the mistakes and go to print. In that regard, we were fortunate because we were able to come up with a printer who had done our pre-press work before, so they were kind of geared up for the process. But then it came time for the next issues, and we had to find someone to do the designing work that John had done, all the designing, all the photo editing, all that kind of creative
all the
work.
Graphics for everything.
Yeah,
fonts,
yeah,
every
everything,
colors,
everything. Yeah,
from
yeah.
the beginning,
from day one. Yeah, so what a tough deal to replace a guy like that. Not only that, one of the neatest guys you'd ever meet.
I mean,
just a you know, just a big heart guy. You know, just never had a conflict with anybody. You know, just a neat guy. Everybody loved him.
Yeah.
And so we had to, but the thing we knew, the three of us, myself, Steve Cole, and our advertising manager, Steve Mader, is we knew that we had to find a path forward because that's exactly what John would have wanted. He would have never wanted us to falter. Mm-hmm. He would have wanted us to not only keep doing what we're doing, but do it better and better and better. That was always his mission. He always put the reader first. He always wanted to do what was best for our readers, in particular our subscribers, a lot of whom have been with us a lot of years. So we knew we had to craft a path forward. We were able to do that through the company that does our pre-press. They also have a design house, and we were able to reach an agreement with them so that we're using one of their designers to do the design work now. Yeah.
And so you were able to kind of transfer John's vision for the magazine to your new design team?
Yeah, and it's a ongoing, it's an evolution.
Right.
You know, we're still making sure that it took us 3 or 4 issues to get our feet on the ground. I think now we're at the point where we are comfortable with the designer's vision kind of meshing with ours.
Yeah.
And we're creating new protocols all the time because there's a lot of things that we just have to reinvent a little bit here.
Yeah.
But it's working out. And I think John will be happy with what we're doing, you know, and our goal is always to create producing a better and better project. We can always improve the product we're putting out there. But now we have this extra motivation to make sure that we're always keeping in our heads, what would John Luke have wanted here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would have made him happy, you know, in terms of presenting this to our readers? Because he always put the readers first, and that's what we try to do too. So, yeah.
And that's a lot of issues too, because you got 4 per year.
Times 3. Well, 6 per year.
Oh.
So 18 print magazines per year total.
So you're every other month.
Yeah, we're bi-monthly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our content, you know, the front end of the book and the back end of the book are the same in all 3 magazines. That's our common forms. That's all our columns.
So that's a lot of issues because you have 6 per magazine. You have 3 magazines.
18.
So that's 18 per year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's quite a little project to get off the ground.
It's a substantial project. And if we didn't have our system down pretty pat, we would have never survived it.
Now, what were you saying about the front and the back?
The front of each of all 3 titles and the back pages, the front 20-some pages and the back 20-some pages are the same in all 3 titles. That's all our columns.
Okay.
We do a variety of different columns that are covering everything from fly tying to lifestyle to history to culture, you know, to conservation. That's all the same in all 3 magazines, but it's the middle of the books, you know, that middle 40-some pages that's mm-hmm. unique to each region. Yeah.
So do all 3 magazines have the same page count?
Yeah.
Which is?
We're up in the 88 range.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you've got about maybe 50-50?
In terms of the regional versus?
Yeah.
It's about that probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a great concept.
Yeah. If it's our content on lifestyle, on fly tying, on culture, on a history, that kind of stuff, that all goes to the whole nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then each magazine had its own regional form, which is all about that region. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that is pretty awesome. Now, tell me what's going on right now with the 3 magazines.
Well, we are pretty excited about this year because, you know, one thing that I had to learn as, you know, when we lost John was that I've got a plan way farther ahead now. Just to avoid running into any road bumps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm planning content out quite a ways in advance, and I've been, you know, one of the things I've always done is actively go out and seek out the best writers and the best photographers, especially if they're people that are new to the fly fishing media, but mm-hmm. they're fly anglers.
Yep.
They're photographers, they're writers, but maybe they have not had that opportunity to get into the national fly fishing media.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really talented, you know, and I've always tried to go out and try to dig those people up, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe they've done a lot of writing in other genres, and fly fishing has been their passion, but they've just never been involved in the fly fishing media. So I'm always trying to find those kind of people, and we've got some coming up that are pretty talented, and will present some just wonderful stuff for our readers. Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, I'm just getting fired up about going fishing. I know it's still here February, but I think I need to get up to the Northwest more often.
Yeah, right. You know, it's interesting, Rob, because I've got a pattern I've followed for about 30 years where, so I'm a wing shooter also.
Yeah.
You know, I have pointing dogs, and our upland season ends at the end of January. And right about the same time, within a week of the end of bird season, we have a hatch of little brown winter stoneflies on a small river in central Oregon. So dry fly fishing in the second week of February, sometimes a snow falling on you. You know, the dry fly action lasts, depending on how cold it is that day, from 30 minutes to a couple hours. But
it's a fun 30 minutes.
I don't care if it's a 9-inch brown trout. If he's rising to a dry fly and it's the snow falling in February, that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's a nice way to kick off the season every year.
Now, what is this book that I'm hearing about, Confessions of a Swinger?
Oh, it's not a book. It's a presentation.
It
may become a book one of these days. But, yeah, it's a catchphrase. It has nothing to do with my college days, I promise. It's all about a technique that we use for fly fishing for steel, the classic technique.
Swinging.
Yeah, the swinging the fly.
You know, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, the easier way. You know, I always tell newbies, you know, if you haven't steeled fish before and you want to try it, don't be intimidated by all the hype and all the mystery and the mystique around this end of fly fishing, because really all you're doing with the classic technique is dragging the fly. You know, we all grew up drifting dry flies on moving water, and you're always trying to like not let the fly drag. all a wet fly swing is, or skating a dry fly, is just swinging the fly, dragging the fly.
Dragging.
You're making it drag. You know, so anybody can master
swinging it.
Yeah, anybody can master it. Yeah, the technique is so simple.
So you give a presentation on that.
Yeah, it's my most popular program by far.
What are some of the key takeaways? Are we allowed to share those? Are those exclusive?
Yeah. No, not at all. You know, first off, I really want, with that program, I really want to demystify it. Steelhead fishing is intimidating to a lot of beginning fly anglers.
Yeah.
And it's because they see the mystique and they see the massive investment in gear that can accompany steelhead fly fishing. But none of that has to happen. None of that has to be a part of it. The technique is very simple. The fly choice is incredibly simple. It's really all a matter of where and when to put that fly. And so that's kind of what the meat of the program is. But yeah, I just try to demystify it for people. Yeah.
It mostly spay.
Both.
You can do single hand?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I learned how to single hand spay this summer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was fun.
It is fun.
I was on the bow.
It's very popular up here, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, now the two-handed casting has worked its way down to trout fishing, you know, and even to pretty light line rods. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't mastered it.
Yeah, there's a few. I'm not a master two-handed caster either. I have a whole quiver of rods that go from 8.5 feet to 15 feet, and they're all steelhead rods. In fact, I've kind of gone backwards in recent years. One of my favorite steelhead rods is an 8.5 foot bamboo rod, single-handed rod.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah.
So where do you like to steelhead fish? I mean, you get a giant northwest region here, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of rivers.
Well, so I don't do a lot of winter steelhead fishing these days, other than on the North Umpqua in March, and that's because I'd rather be chasing my pointing dogs around during January up in the Chucker Hills. But for summer run fish, you know, I fish the Deschutes, I fish the North Umpqua, I fish the Rogue a little bit, and then there's a couple other rivers that we remain unnamed.
Yes, there needs to be a few of those, right?
That's right.
We can't get in trouble with the buddies. But what's going on right now in the Northwest with the steelhead? You hear different stories that some of the returns aren't what they should be.
Yeah, well, you know, essentially a native steelhead is rather imperiled throughout its range. The runs get healthier and healthier as you work your way north. But to put it in perspective, Rob, the founding river of steelhead fly fishing was the Eel River in Northern California. And the founding years were the 1880s and 1890s. That's when it was all kind of worked out. And in those days, anglers from San Francisco were annually making the pilgrimage up to the Eel to fish for steelhead during the fall. These were summer-run life history steelhead. Estimates put the total escapement on the Eel River at 150,000 steelhead across four, maybe five different populations, a couple summer runs, a couple winter runs. So today, to put that in perspective, the Eel River summer-run life history steelhead is extinct. The winter-run life history steelhead is maybe 5% of those historical highs. So that's how much we've lost. And when you start looking at those numbers of total historical escapement up and down the coast, you realize that, yeah, we've got to be awfully careful how we tread here as a population, or we're going to start having those kind of losses on rivers moving northward, and we're starting to see that in some of the places, you know. So it's an ongoing battle. You know, we've got quite a number of summer run and winter run steelhead fisheries that are supported by hatchery steelhead. And that's it's a contentious issue right now, because the science shows that in a lot of cases they don't coexist very well, and it's usually to the peril of the native populations. But I will say on the flip side of that is, if you were right today to say we are going, by tomorrow morning there will be no hatchery steelhead at all in the entire Columbia and Snake River system, I don't think we'd have more than one river we'd be fishing. Now, granted, if you did that and then said, let's give a decade to each of those rivers to recover their wild fish, that might happen. But without those hatchery fish, I don't think we're going to be fishing a lot of those Columbian upper snake tributaries. So, yeah, I mean, it's a different dynamic, but, you know, it's a dynamic that has to be, you know, considered from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hear they're even doing some closing of some rivers to try to let this restoration happen.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's some examples of that right here in Washington, but I certainly don't have all the answers to this or even pretend to know all the answers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess in a lot of ways I consider myself fortunate, because in the years when I was working in that fly shop, myself and Forrest Maxwell were fishing for steelhead in the summer virtually every night. And we caught a lot of fish because there were robust runs. So I'm really grateful to have had that decade.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never stopped fanatically fly fishing for summer run steelhead, but I've never had a decade like that.
Yeah. You know? Well, I guess just a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion, and,
yeah, and
a lot of minds.
Bring everybody to the table.
Yeah, we need a lot of minds on this to try to, you know,
no
fix
question.
It.
Yeah, no question.
You have this book that's out here. It's the Classic Steelhead Flies.
It's my newest fly fishing book, and one of the most fun that I ever put together, because the research was fascinating to me. I love the history. Part of that research was digging into old newspapers from San Francisco, you know, the San Francisco Call and some of those other Northern California newspapers, because that's where it started.
Yeah.
You know? Not to mention the, you know, the Oregonian and the Seattle newspapers and that kind of thing. But, you know, you get back, you're digging through a issue of the San Francisco Call from, say, 1885 or something like that, and you get sidetracked so easy.
Yeah.
Because I know what I'm looking for. But then you start reading these stories about all kinds of other historical things that, you know, to us now are like, wow, that really happened.
Yeah.
You know? Had nothing to do with fly fishing.
Yeah, but it was cool.
So the research took five times as long as it should have, you know.
But tell us a great story that you learned through that period.
Well, I don't know if it's a great story, but it's a poignant story and an educational one. One of the things I kept running into in those Northern California newspapers was what they called the Chinese problem. And it reminded me a lot of our current debate these days on immigrants from Central and South America, in that they call it the Chinese problem because Chinese labor was taking a lot of the difficult jobs, especially in the fish hatcheries up on the rivers in Northern California. The canneries that were canning Pacific salmon. And almost all the labor was done by Chinese laborers who actually were brought in by the cannery owners, you know, by boat, and yet not made to feel welcome at all. And actually vilified, you know, in the same way that migrant workers can be vilified here now. And
yeah.
And I'm reading these stories and I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I were to take this story from 1880 or 1885 about the so-called Chinese problem and cross out the word Chinese and put Hispanic, you wouldn't know that this didn't run in some media outlet today.
Or change the date.
Yeah, I mean, it was really eye-opening. And I thought, you know, we've been, as a culture, we've been confronting the same kind of prejudices for a lot of years, you know, and maybe not learned a lot from it. Mm. So those were kind of some of the things that I really remember reading some of those things. And,
yeah.
And then reading about the great fire that destroyed San Francisco in 1906. I mean, man, you know, the whole downtown area, you know, just up and
gone.
Yeah.
Well, tell our listeners about this fire.
Well, it's a famous fire that occurred that essentially gutted downtown San Francisco. And during my research, I uncovered essentially the guy that really should be given credit as the founding father of steelhead fly fishing. And his name was John Benn, famous fly tyer from San Francisco. But he'd been lost to history, you know, just completely lost. And one of his buddies was a guy named John Butler. And John Butler owned an ale house in downtown San Francisco. And it would be John Butler that befriended John Benn enough that he really wanted to send John Benn up and buy him a house on the Eel River when he retired. And that didn't happen, I think, because there was some crazy stuff going on between John Benn and his son-in-law.
Oh, boy.
Just, yeah, really dramatic, you know, like soap opera stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, and it's in the book. The fire itself, you know, when you do all this research on John Butler and his ale house and how he was importing scotch from Scotland and importing ales from Great Britain, you know, I mean, just neat stuff, you know. And then you find out that it all went up in smoke in the big fire. Mm. You know, it's like that hit a little closer to home than it might have if I hadn't done all the research on John Benn.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
That is interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, as I went through your book, The Classic Steelhead Flies, you could see like a distant cousin, but a similar style on some of these steelhead flies is almost like an Atlantic salmon pattern.
No question. Yeah. It's interesting you bring that up, Rob, because some of the earliest steelhead flies were Atlantic salmon patterns. So the most important thing that happened in the last 200 years in California from this perspective of tracing the history of steelhead flies was what happened in 1849, the gold rush.
Mm-hmm.
Instantly, overnight, 300,000 new Californians, essentially. You know, within a few months, there were 300,000 people went to California.
Yeah.
If you were from New England, if you were from England or Ireland, and you were an angler, when you decided to head for the gold rush country and you wanted to bring your tackle, you were bringing what you had.
Right.
That's why the first steelhead flies were eastern trout flies and British flies.
Because of the gold rush.
Because they brought them there when they came.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the first flies fished for trout in California were the flies that they brought with them. And then when they discovered this weird fish that they didn't really know what it was, but they knew that it went to salt water and came out of salt water like a salmon, but didn't die after spawning. So they did the most logical thing imaginable. They called him a salmon trout.
That's
perfect.
Would make
right?
sense.
Yeah, it'd make perfect sense. Yeah. And then they discovered that their trout flies that they had been fishing all over the California with, you know, for a couple of decades, worked pretty good on these salmon trout. And then they start, you know, salmon trout are pretty big. They're bigger than your average trout. So they started upsizing the hooks a little bit and tying these wet flies a little bigger and branching out and starting to tie flies specifically for salmon trout, specifically for what would become called a steelhead. And so, you know, during the 1870s, but especially the 1880s and 1890s, it was an explosive time for the development of steelhead-specific flies.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. Yeah.
what is a steelhead specific fly? Because when you look at them, you see lots of colors and different materials, but you're not matching a hatch.
No, you're not
imitating a bait fish or
anything.
You're
not, yeah.
What makes up a steelhead fly? How do you know a good one versus a not good one?
Well, the thing about the steelhead is, I'll give you an anecdote. There's a fellow named Lee Spencer, and he is the pool guardian down on the North Umpqua, hired by the North Umpqua Foundation. He has spent more hours just observing steelhead than anybody ever.
Ever.
And if you read his meticulous notes and decided to base your fly choice on his notes, you would tie all your flies to represent a maple leaf. So what he observes is, he calls them approaches. He studies the pool, watches the fish. Sometimes a fish will break out of the bottom and go approach something in the drift. And he's listed everything he's ever seen a steelhead approach in that manner, which is the same way they're going to approach a fly, a swinging fly, right? The biggest category is maple leaves. Coincidentally, they're also the most abundant thing in the drift. But he has recorded steelhead reacting to everything from like fir needles to kingfishers flying across the flow. He actually swung up a steelhead on a skated pistachio shell once on the North Umpqua River. If a steelhead will skate up to a pistachio shell, your particular choice in pattern, color, or style doesn't matter.
Mm.
When the steelhead is ready to approach something and maybe bite it, it really doesn't matter what you swing. So that's a hard sell for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, but it's more important to pick a few patterns and have faith in them and not worry about it too much. You know, so over the years, steelhead flies have evolved. They have their roots in Atlantic salmon flies and East Coast wet flies, like the Parmachine Belle is one. You know,
sure.
Beautiful, colorful Parmachine Belle was one of the most popular steelhead flies for 30 years in the early days. But when you have those colorful flies, you know, they're being fly tires. We're always going to tool things. We're all going to retool and reinvent and, you know, add our own little touch. And that's what happened 100 years ago as well. The fly tires of the day would take a Parmachine Belle or a Coachman and say, okay, I'm going to add a red strip in the wing, or I'm, you know, and make their own little signature on it and then change the name.
So it's a lot of art. It's a lot of personal choice and having fun with it.
Yeah. You know, you go to the Henry's Fork and there are pale morning duns hatching and you're observing a trout rising for pale morning duns. You can be pretty sure that the best thing you can do is find a fly that imitates that pale morning dun.
Yeah.
That's not the case with steelhead. We don't know why they rise for flies. We have
idea. Well, I'm glad it wasn't just me.
Not just you. Yeah. But I think the sooner that you accept that and understand that you're not fishing to a trout, you know, so it's more important what you do with that fly than
it's the presentation.
Yeah, and in the right water.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a different beast.
Why don't you give us a quick synopsis on your latest book, The Steelhead, Classic Steelhead Flies.
Well, yeah, that again, this is the one that I spent so much time researching and I just enjoyed the heck out of it. But the opening chapters are essentially the history of how we got here, you know, with these flies and with steelhead fly fishing. And then it goes into the beef of the book is presenting the patterns themselves. And it presents dozens and dozens of the classic flies and gives a little history about each fly. You know, so that was kind of fun for me, too, was to really dive into each fly. And, you know, there's a person or people behind every fly. And sometimes that's the most interesting part, is getting at the personalities behind those flies. You know, and when you're trying to deal with someone who died 100 years ago, the job gets a little more difficult. But, you know, it's fun. You have to be, as a historian, you have to have sound methodology. So, you know, you have to get outside the fly fishing literature. That's the first thing. Because if you read something in a fly fishing book and it's wrong, and then another author is only using fly fishing literature as his sources, then he's going to repeat that mistake.
Yeah.
So it's important to get outside the fly fishing literature. And this is advice to anybody who wants to write fly fishing history. Get outside the literature and look at all the other sources that are available to you. So, you know, I found all kinds of great information by just getting way beyond fly fishing, the very limited amount of fly fishing literature, and getting out there and finding things out about people from our past that are beyond their fly fishing life. Yeah, pretty cool.
That is such great information, John. It's been so fun talking with
you. Absolutely, Rob, yeah.
And I really appreciate you coming on our podcast and learning so much about Northwest and Southwest and Eastern fly fishing magazines.
And can I throw the plug in?
I was just about to help you there.
www.matchthehatch.com.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And people can find all three magazines there.
Absolutely.
And then you have a website, too, for your books and stuff.
Well, I have one for the Classic Steelhead Flies book. That's classicsteelheadflies.com.
Yep. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cool. It's been great to get to know you a little bit,
pleasure,
John.
Yeah.
And I can see why the magazines have done so well with people like yourself behind them, and all the best to them.
Thank you.
And yourself. So thank you for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.